Hey people, I hope you all are well today. With me this afternoon in the Crystal Vision Studios is an awesome musician that I met probably a year or so ago down in Galveston, Texas. Sometime later, I sat in on a couple of shows he was playing with a mutual friend and musician, Zach Perry. Fast forward about 6 months or so, and he and I are now playing shows together almost on a weekly basis. When we come back, I'll get into a chat with my friend and fellow singer-songwriter Chris Hughes, so make sure you stay close by.
This is Backstage Pass Radio, the podcast that's designed for the music junkie with a thirst for musical knowledge. Hi, this is Adam Gordon, and I want to thank you all for joining us today. Make sure you like, subscribe, and turn alerts on for this and all upcoming podcasts. And now, here's your host of Backstage Pass Radio, Randy Halsey.
Chris, great to see you, buddy.
Good to see you.
Glad you were able to swing by the studio before our show out here in Cypress this evening at Creekwood Grill. We always enjoy jamming at Creekwood Grill. So if you guys keep a lookout for Chris and mine's schedule, I think we're there probably once a month is probably what it equates to, probably every 5 weeks or so. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about growing up in West Texas. So Odessa, to be exact, correct?
Exactly.
What was life like as a kid growing up? I'm assuming you grew up in Odessa, correct?
Yeah, I got to Odessa when I was about 4 years old. My parents were in the oil field, and they got transplanted there. Both of them had gone to OU and came to Odessa and had jobs in the oil field, and we just started out there. And so it's extremely flat, it's extremely dry, and there was a lot of good old boys and all that kind of stuff.
And a tumbleweed or two floating around?
Tumbleweed or two.
Yeah, so the parents were from Oklahoma originally, or where were they from originally?
Dad was from Oklahoma. Mom was in the Houston area, had grown up. Actually, Mom grew up in Houston, and I believe she went to Memorial High School. So
okay. Yeah. So she had roots here in
she
town.
She had roots here, and they both, yeah, wound up at OU and met there.
Okay. And do you remember much about what life was like growing up there as a kid?
Oh, in Odessa?
Yeah.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was one of the best places in the world to grow up because it was a real tight-knit community. And there wasn't anything to do there. We made our own fun, lots of bike riding and stuff like that. But, and so for me, at 6 years old, I started playing guitar. And in between, sports and motorcycles and girls and everything, I took up guitar at 6 years old and wound up plunking around in the garage and having people poke fun at me because I sounded like crap.
Well, they say you got to go through hell before you get to heaven, right?
I guess we're still going.
Well, I think there's a, what word am I looking for? I've been on a plane before where I was flying into Houston, and there was a couple next to me, and they're looking out the window as we're starting to get low enough to see the terrain of Houston. They're like, wow, there's a lot of trees in Houston. Like, and I think the mindset of people is they stereotype Texas as the wild, wild west, and there's no trees, there's no vegetation. And I think that that's kind of the vision I have of West Texas, because I've never really spent time in West Texas. So I think of the Permian Basin, I think of Midland and Odessa as just the Wild West with tumbleweeds, right? I've been to Abilene
and you're pretty much correct, because it's big, it's flat, and there's a lot of tumbleweeds, and across the plains, they say that in West Texas, it's the only place in the world that you can watch your dog run away for 2 weeks, and so he just keeps going. And you can watch him go.
Like no end in sight.
No end in sight. Yeah.
You might have mentioned this earlier, and I didn't catch it. How long did you live in Odessa?
I lived in Odessa until I was probably almost 30 years old when I left on my first set of tours, and I left with Steve O'Neill, and he was based out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so it was kind of culture shock for me because Odessa, Texas at that time was 95, 100,000 people. And we went from there and we went toured all over the country and everything, but we were based out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was considerably bigger than Odessa. And so it was kind of strange for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I got you. And then, do you remember around what year it was that you left the Odessa area and took off on tour?
Probably 89, 90, somewhere around there. But okay. It's a long time ago, and I drank a lot.
You forgot more than you ever knew, huh?
It's been a long road.
Yeah, and it's sometimes my memory of things way back is better than asking me what I had for lunch yesterday, because I'm not going to remember that. But for some reason, I remember hearing Paul McCartney and Wings playing in an elevator in Anaheim, California in 1978. Why did I remember that? But like I said, I don't remember if I had a Happy Meal or McNuggets yesterday. Is there anything about West Texas that you miss versus, you know, I know you're down on the island in Galveston now. The Houston area, Galveston.
I miss the people. Yeah. The people of West Texas are where it's at.
Okay.
And I have I still have great family there. My cousin Jason and Bessie and Mark and Bob and Ronnie and Des and Ann and Shay and all the family down there. They, over the last couple of years, I spent a lot of time down there working and stuff like that. And so, but I went to high school down there and up there, I guess I should say. And so it's that is the thing about that everybody remembers about West Texas, the people.
And it's not compared to Houston, it's small town, but it's not really small town, but it's that small town mentality of
correct.
The people.
Yeah,
right?
Because Odessa is probably, well, now it's over 100,000. At that time, it was around 100,000. Midland's 20 miles away, and it was about 100,000. And now they've kind of grown together, and so the area has grown quite a bit. And now, of course, with oil, it's exploded. There, it's gone nuts, and so the people, it has grown exponentially faster than the infrastructure of the area can handle.
Sure.
And so it's just gone crazy.
That makes sense. Well, my neighbors that are right across the street from me, they're not from Midland, Odessa, but they did go to school in Lubbock at Tech. So both of my neighbors went there, and now both of their kids are at Tech in Lubbock,
and they
love Lubbock. Like, they speak very highly of Lubbock, even though they're not from Lubbock.
That's exactly the thing about Lubbock as well, is because when I was touring with Steve O'Neill, we spent a considerable amount of time down there playing in Lubbock, and fantastic place.
Yep, and you remember, so you mentioned you started playing the guitar at 6 years old. Is that, when did you really start, do you think, getting into music? I'm sure at 6 years old, you're making some sounds on the guitar. And
we started getting into about the time we moved to Odessa, my parents had a couple of records that they had. And one of the records they had was a Ventures album. And the back of the Ventures album was a Mosrite electric guitar. And I remember sitting there on the living room floor, laying there, listening to that album and just dreaming of playing. And I bugged them and I bugged them and I bugged them. And so finally they wound up getting me a guitar when I was about 6 years old. So I started early. As soon as I got that one, I started playing and started bugging them for an electric guitar. And so we continued. And they probably made me play the acoustic for about 2 years before I got the electric. But I knew really early exactly what it was I wanted to do.
That's a common denominator of most all of the musicians that I've had on my show, is it's like they knew the first minute they did A, B, or C that was music related, that was it.
Yeah, I think the most common one that I've ever heard was, I was watching the Beatles play on Ed Sullivan and I knew,
yep,
blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And the story goes. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, that same type epiphany.
Yep. And they say that, if you learn on the acoustic, you can play it on the acoustic, you can play it on just about anything, right? Because the acoustic's usually probably a little bit tougher to play than an electric guitar with lighter gauge strings.
Yeah, and learning was considerably different back then than it is now, where you can, you know, a kid can get on YouTube and go find out how to play anything. And back then, you know, you put an album on the turntable and they threw an acoustic guitar at you and you beat the hell out of it until you figured right. out how to make a sound or whatever. And so, yeah, actually figuring out how to play with records didn't come till a few years later.
Sure.
And that was actually my first figuring out how to play rock, as I stumbled across the power chord when I was over at my brother's house listening to a Black Sabbath record, mm-hmm. like the Black Sabbath Paranoid album.
Yeah.
And I learned that power chord, and I guess it was all downhill yeah. from there.
That's all it took.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think kids are learning probably just in a fraction of the time that it took you and I as kids. But we didn't have the learning materials. We didn't have YouTube. We didn't have tablature. There was no such thing as tablature back in the day, right?
Certainly.
We wore the hell out of a record or a cassette tape or CD, whatever era you kind of grew up in. But you listen to that thing over, rewind, over, 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 until you ingrained the sound into your head, and then you went back and you mimicked
that. The other
sound.
Side of that coin is that I come across so many people now that play in a niche. And so as far as improvising or just picking up your guitar and jamming with people across multiple styles, whether it be playing some rock or some blues, or even, you know, plunking at some jazz or whatever it is, their skills at improvisation aren't nearly as good as some of the people who just came up playing everything and playing by ear.
Absolutely.
That's, you know, it's, I don't want to stereotype, but I think that's kind of generally true. The guys who came up a little bit older wind up being able to jam and improvise across more styles than some of the guys that are coming up today, learning off of YouTube, learning one style of music, whatever.
Sure, and I have to say that I don't know that you necessarily have to be an accomplished guitarist, but you have to have the foundation. If you have the foundations of keys, playing in certain keys, like you're a prime example of that. Whether you know, the night we played at Creekwood, you're up there playing stuff with me. You and I never rehearsed before we started playing shows together, because you have the foundation and you have the knowledge to be able to say he's in this key, and then you get the rhythm of the song, and then it's feel for you more than anything.
It's all feel, yeah, because I don't know how to read music. I don't know how to read tablature. I don't know how to do any of that sort of thing. And it's a detriment. It's not something I'm proud of. But I've tried to make the best of it, you know, and so you tell me kind of what key we're in and off we go.
Sure.
And that's one of the reasons that Zach and I play so well.
Absolutely.
Together, and some of the other guys, you know, that's one of the reasons that, or Steve, when I was playing with Steve, I was primarily a bass player. And it's one of the things that I kind of take pride in and want to be is a best side man. I've mm-hmm. never really wanted to be the star. I've always wanted to be a really good sideman and yep. be able to play whatever it was I was called in to play, whether it was a bass part or a guitar part or a vocal part or whatever.
Yep. Well, I kept hearing from a mutual friend of ours down in Galveston before I met you. I kept hearing Chris Hughes. And I'm like, who is this guy, Chris Hughes? I hear his name all the time. And then I, you know, fast forward, I go and I see you and Zach play, and I'm like, oh, this is Chris Hughes. But I didn't realize, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but I didn't realize that you had been tied to Zach in the band, you know, Zach's band before that. So it all kind of starts making sense in my head, kind of where you're from and, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Right.
But it took me a little bit of piecing the things together. I just kept hearing the name, and I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, I don't know who Chris Hughes is, right? Just like he doesn't know who
I am, and right? Once again, when I started playing with Zach, I was playing bass. And when I started playing down in Galveston, I was playing bass as well with a guy named Skip Devlin, who's just an incredible guitar player.
Yeah.
Man, I'm not sure what he's playing now, but I was playing with bass with him as well. And so, you know, it's always, you know, been one of my things to kind of stand, you know, be in the shadows a little bit more.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Let somebody else be the star.
Absolutely. And a lot of people are okay with that. I mean, you look at so many backup singers that backup singer for Dylan or Aerosmith or Motley Crue, you know, they all had backup singers on tour with them. And those people in their own right are, I mean, they make me look like, you know, crap from a vocal perspective, right? But they're in the background. They're not, they could be out front somewhere, but they don't, that's not what they choose to do, apparently, or they would have chosen something else, I guess. So everybody knows their place, right?
As a good side man, you can work and consistently work, you know?
Yep. Well, you said that you're self-taught. There's really no music theory background for Chris Hughes at all. And I see that split. So many people that I've talked to, they don't have a theory background, and there's nothing at all wrong with that. And some of the best musicians don't have a theory background. Well, I have a little bit of both, even though if you put the guitar and mine in your hand, people would say, oh, Chris is a far better player than you, and he's so much more knowledgeable than you, but you really don't know what you know what I'm saying? Oh, so the playability doesn't mean that you don't have a music background at all, right?
That plays out. You can see that time and time again, you know, with, any conductor is a perfect example of that. A guy might not be able to play every instrument up there, but he knows what every instrument is doing.
And needs to do, for that matter, right?
And can hear the difference one way or the other. And so, you know, and I did get a little bit of theory and a little bit of formal education, and I went to a year of college out of high school. Of course, Mom was saying, you got to go to school. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? And I said, well, okay, fine, I'll go, and I'll take all music. Then I found out real quick that I got in above my head.
Sure. I took many years of theory. I sang in the choir in school, and they teach a lot of music theory, how to read music, like, and understand half steps, whole steps, and how the voice needs to acclimate to those changes. And I'm dumb. Like, I'm a dumb musician compared to so many out there. I mean, there is so, you never stop learning music. It's like, it's kind of like you made the comment about letting the dog run in Odessa and he'd be lost for, you know, 2 weeks. It's the same thing in music. I mean, you can study and study and study and still not know everything there is to know about music. It's amazing.
A perfect example is all the people that I had when I went to college. All of those kids had been in school taking music for years and could read music on their individual instruments. And, mm-hmm. and many of them were the best in their sections at their individual schools.
Yeah.
But as far as improvising a solo or any other, most of them had no clue on how to do that. So they could read music and they could play their instrument relatively well. They could do pretty good. But when it came to jamming, couldn't happen. And so, and for me, that was one of the hardest things, was trying to get my theory and my music education caught up to where my playing ability was. And so I still struggle with that today, you know.
Sure. Well, I think for me, it was always that I don't have the best voice in the world compared to so many, but I think I have a good enough voice to go out and do what you and I do together. But I was able to, say, keep the instrumentation or the instrumental part simple because you can add your vocals in there and deliver something. Whereas I think sometimes people will say, well, I'm not a good singer, so I'm going to be a great lead player. I'm going to be flashy in that way. And I don't think that's the case for everybody, but I think that everybody kind of knows their role. Like, you sing, play lead, play rhythm, you do everything, right? Whereas I don't, if I play a lead, it's so simple. Like, I don't consider myself a lead guitarist. And you either understand that and the building blocks of that, the scales or the cage system or whatever, right? I mean, there's a bunch of different ways to play leads, but you either get it or you don't. It's kind of like programming a software. Like, you either know how to do it or you don't know how to do it. There's no dabbling
in so it. Much of it, you know, and especially for somebody like me, so much of it is just repetition and hand training and things like that for a person who plays by ear, because just like anybody else. You look at a circle, and now you've looked at a circle so many times, you don't have to recognize it, that you don't have to stop and think, hey, that's a circle. You just know it's a circle.
Exactly.
It's the same thing with music, playing, whether it's guitar or bass or whatever, after a certain amount of time. And that's why you practice.
Yep, I agree. And you talked a little bit about you were playing bass with Zach and I guess played bass in the past. Are there any other instruments that Chris considers that he's an instrumentalist around? Like, can you play a saxophone? And you know what I'm saying? Or is it really just the string, like the guitar and the bass is really your forte and everything else is just kind of...
I play guitar and I play bass. I sing. I play at the drums. And all of the things that I've learned have been kind of out of necessity. You know, what I need, I want to do so-and-so, so the only way that we can do it is learn. For me to learn how to do it, you know. And so, and that's kind of how I learned drums, and sure. So I can hold down a groove. But between those three, I can generally get ideas down. Sure. I can record and do the things that I need to do.
Yep, that makes sense. And if you could play another instrument outside of what you play today or know how to play, and you could play it as well as you say you play the guitar, what would that other instrument be?
I would most certainly be a drummer. But other than that, I probably at this time would, I'd probably play sax because, I like sax. My wife likes sax a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, you got to keep my wife.
I figure if I learn how to play sax, maybe I get in the good graces over there or something. I don't know.
Maybe she'll feed you dinner one more night.
Yeah, you know, I piss her off really good sometime, and I could walk in the house wailing a good sax line and get me out of some crap. So I don't know.
You're figuring it all out as we go, I know.
Always got to have a plan. And you're looking ahead, man.
And always hustling, right?
That's it.
So you're now a resident of Galveston by way of Magnolia, Texas. So talk to me a little bit about, you left Odessa, you went on the road, you did whatever, then you landed in Magnolia somehow. Talk to me a little bit about how did you find Magnolia, and then from there, what took you from Magnolia down to the island?
Right. When I came off the road, I went back to Odessa, played for a while with the Chris Hughes band. We played there for a little bit. Things in West Texas, there wasn't a lot going on, so I wound up moving to Houston. I wasn't in Houston, but about 6 months. The first people that I met when I got to Houston, the very first audition interview that I went on, I got hired for that band, and it wasn't as soon as we learned our material. We went from Houston to International Falls, Minnesota for a one-night gig, and we started our first tour. And when we came back, I wound up moving to Magnolia because the keyboard player at the time had bought a place out there in Magnolia, and so it just seemed like a logical place for us all to kind of hole up where we were close.
Makes sense.
So that's where I kind of wound up out in Magnolia.
Okay, and then how long were you in Magnolia?
I was in and out of Magnolia for several years because we in and out touring back and forth. And then I finally came back and I lived in Magnolia and went straight from being on tour to being the reproduction manager for a petroleum consultants company and the assistant to the vice president of information systems. And so it was kind of culture shock immediately. Stayed out there for a couple of years until probably 2006, started working down in Galveston. I worked down there for a couple of years and I wound up moving there in 2010. So I've been in Galveston ever since then.
There is a song that you wrote that has Magnolia in the title, and it's a song that you frequently play in our shows, and I was wondering if you would grab the Gibson and maybe tell the listeners a little bit about the song, maybe what your thoughts were around the song when you wrote it, and then share it live here on the show.
I'll be honored.
All right.
Essentially, and honest to goodness, this is one of those things where I was sitting out on the front porch in Magnolia, Texas, and just had grabbed the acoustic, had the grill going, popped a cold beer, listening to the breeze, and strummed a little bit, and this is the tune that came out. It's called Magnolia Oaks.
Magnolia Oaks by my friend Chris Hughes here in the studio. Chris, great work. I know the crowd always enjoys the instrumental. I think it's a little deviation from what we do for sure, because we're always singing songs and playing the guitar. So a nice instrumental comes across nicely sometimes.
I'm certainly a deviant.
So thanks for sharing that with us. And do you prefer playing music on the island, or, and plead the fifth on this, do you prefer playing music on the island, or is the preference to get off of the island? I don't know if there's a vibe on the island that you don't get in the city, or a vibe you get in the city that you don't get on the island. And is there a preference one way or another for you as a musician?
As far as playing, I don't necessarily know that so much. The island has its own attitude, and you kind of carry that with you everywhere.
Right.
Most of us on the island will say that we avoid going off over that bridge at any cost.
Sure.
Unless we're going to make some money or, you know, something like that. And so you kind of carry that with you. But so that being said, no, performing anywhere is good. When the crowd's receptive and it's good and the music's good, that's a great thing. But you kind of carry, I have learned to carry that island with me.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
And that's, it's interesting because I've not only seen you play, I've seen Zach play down, you know, at Sharky's. I've played some tunes with you guys at the Poop Deck. And it's definitely, for the city guy coming down to the island, it's definitely a locals only kind of vibe. Like, I mean, there's, you can tell that there's people that, you have the islanders and then you have the Randys that come down there. You can, and I can tell the difference in, yeah, in the two. And I think, and I only say that because I think it's just a little more laid back, you know, the dress, this dress down there, I think it's just real casual, and you can tell that, you know, that guy in the corner is an island guy, and that guy might have driven over the bridge to get into town, right?
Well, we're a little salty.
Well, you have to be to live down there, right? Yeah. I mean, you don't have a choice, I don't think. Tell me about your musical influences. You know, you talked about starting out real young, learning to play the guitar. You love the guitar. Who influenced you? I know you talked about the one album that your parents had, but there had to have been other musicians along the way, other bands that, you know, for some of my people that have been on the show, it was the Beatles. For some, it was Mitch Mitchell from Hendrix, you know, the drumming style of Mitch Mitchell. And who was it for you, or who were some of the people?
Well, it's real funny because the first records I got were actually, you know, mom knew I loved music, and she went down and she got me a record player. And the first two records, she went to Gibson Discount Center right around the corner and came back with Alice Cooper School's Out and James Gang Rides Again. And I had, it was like fifth, sixth grade, and she pops these bad boys on me. And up until then, you know, it was the Ventures, and I'd, you know, listen to some Creedence, and Donny Osmond was real popular at that time.
Sure.
So she throws out the James Gang and Alice Cooper. Then I got I had a girlfriend that was an eighth grader. Ooh. And I was in sixth grade, and she gave me a copy of Deep Purple Machine Head.
Yeah.
And so that kind of stuff is where I was cutting my teeth. James Gang, Alice Cooper, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Pat Travers was a huge influence of mine, just the way he played the sound of his songs. Van Halen was a big influence, all those kind of guys. And when you listen to me play now, it's not especially in the acoustic stuff, you wouldn't necessarily think that, but that's where my playing came from.
Well, it sounds like a melting pot. Like it was a little bit of everything. And for you, just like you said, for me, even it was, you know, I was down with the Motown sound. I loved the Motown stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I loved the hard rock. I loved the easy rock, the what we call yacht rock now, right? I was never of course, rap really didn't come till much later. I wouldn't say that I'm so much a rap guy. But I wasn't so much a country guy either. But when I started playing solo shows back in 2016, I said, you got to get your arms around some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You can't go and play these shows as a solo artist and not know Folsom Prison Blues and some of the classics on the on the acoustic.
And for musicians, I'm not sure that there was ever that huge of a division musically and styles, you know. Rock players love the Motown, the soul stuff, all that kind of stuff. And until disco came.
Sure.
And then there was huge division that kind of came between musical styles, and things kind of started going weird from there. But
yeah. Well, I'm also, you know, we talk about, I think there was a lot of haters of the disco era, and I wouldn't say that I was a huge disco fan, but I believe that some of the greatest singer-songwriters that have ever walked the planet were the brothers Gibb from the Bee Gees, right?
And I mean, that would have been one of my prime examples of something good that came out of that era.
Yeah.
And even at the time, I wouldn't have told you that then. I would have said they're a bunch of hacks and they suck.
Yeah.
But I've grown up since then to understand what it was that they did within the business and what they did within their own style and how they reinvented themselves and how they completely reinvented music in a lot of ways. Sure. You know, I mean, looking back on it now, you know, after all these years, it's a little bit easier to get a hold of what it was that they were doing. And at the time, you know, I had no clue.
Well, I think, I don't know that people really took disco all that serious musically, right? I mean, there was a lot of good music that came out of the disco era. I mean, there was some great songs that came out. I believe, but you know, the songwriting styles of the Bee Gees, you know, how many number one hit songs did they have? I mean, they wrote for Dolly Parton. They did Islands in the Stream. They did work with Celine Dion. They worked with Whitney Houston. And I mean, they wrote hit songs for all of those people. And a lot of people don't even realize that.
True. And you know, once again, a lot of that stuff had become so formulaic, and it's, you know, it's it And that's recognizing what was catching and writing to that formula and all that stuff. And so, yeah, there are some good things about that. Once you recognize what it is, you can write to that formula and begin to write hits better. Then the other side of that coin is that as you write to a formula like disco and you get that 3-minute song, has to be 3 minutes, has to be in and out. You know, we start with a verse, we do a chorus, we got a bridge, we do verse, chorus, bridge, and we're out. And we got to do it within 3 minutes. It takes some of the artistic choice away from the artist, you know. Sure. If you're writing for a 3-minute song, you know, it's difficult to put too much more in than in and out.
Yeah, I get that. Well, would you say that songwriting comes easy for you, or is songwriting a struggle for you? Because I've always said, and I've mentioned it in multiple podcasts, that you're either a lyricist or you're a lyrical airhead. Like, you either can write a song or you can't write a song. And I didn't know from your vantage point, songwriting, easy for you, hard for you?
I say it's hard for me. And the reason I say that is because I don't write a lot. And what I do write generally comes to me and it flows out pretty quickly. Very rarely do I take a song and work on it for a long, long period of time. I either cough it up really fast or whatever. And so lyrically, it's hard for me to write certain things.
Sure.
The happy-go-lucky song is hard for me to write. Yep. I tend to write
melancholy and...
Yeah, and try to find some big, deep meaning in everything. And let's face it, you know, it's hard to write a whole album worth of songs where everything has a deep meaning and a lesson involved and you stop and ponder. And so it's difficult for me. And so I like to write with people. I like to play with people who are good writers.
Yeah.
And that was one of the fortunate things. I've been very, very fortunate to work with two guys who are extremely good writers. Steve O'Neill was a fantastic writer. He just got through winning 2 New Mexico Music Awards. One of the tunes that he had on his record, and I had won an award, had been recorded 4 different times. We recorded it on one of his records, and he just kept going at it. And so he's a very good pop writer and writes good ballads. And Zach Perry is, to me, one of the best lyricists, period. Mm-hmm. And certainly something that the Texas songwriter scene should be proud of. And so I was real fortunate to work with both those guys, and studying what they do has helped me a lot, you know. So
sure. Well, that's a nice compliment, you know, about Zach, being that I know him personally. Hopefully his head doesn't get too big after you giving him a nice compliment like that.
No, I pay him for all that stuff.
There's money handed under the table. Yeah,
there's money. He can't, you know.
He's got to have a cheeseburger, right? You got to buy him a cheeseburger from time to time. Would you say that the songs that you do write, are they coming from true life experiences mostly, or are they more, let me just pick a word and write around the word like it's not even a true story kind of thing?
Most certainly true life experiences. Most certainly. And there may be an experience that a family member has had, and I will write from it from first person.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure.
But certainly I write best things that I've felt.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I would agree with you about Zach. I've really paid attention to the songwriting of his over the few years that I've known him. And I think when he was in France, he wrote a song called Little Ponies. And it was, I don't know, it's just interesting how the song came about and how quickly they seemed to come to him. And that's why I said earlier, you're either a lyricist or you're a lyrical airhead and you can't think of anything to write about. But he takes a pony and turns it into a song.
Okay. Well, yeah, but once again, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's like any other muscle that you have. You know, he didn't develop lyrical prowess by not writing.
Absolutely.
You know, he writes a lot. The guy's got 15 albums out, you know. Sure. And I was just real fortunate to be able to have worked with him in the past. And then when he came back from France this time, it was kind of a surprise to both of us that he was back here. And subsequently also, it was kind of neat to be able to be in a position where we could record And we had, by the time he left, he had finished his parts and got a 6-song kind of a glorified EP that's ready to go right now. It'll be mastered in Austin at Terra Nova Studios just soon. It's going to be dropping probably within the month or so.
And I'm looking forward to that. I know you and I joke a little bit about how long it's taken to get that out, but I'm looking forward to hearing it. I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah, one more joke and I'm going to quit. Keep jacking with me.
So it's time for Randy's commercial. If there's any lead guitarists out there that are looking for work, I don't know how much longer Chris and I will be working together.
Yeah, we're gonna be together about one more joke. And the way things go around here, that's about 5 minutes.
Well, that's about 4 minutes longer than I thought it would be. But Dan Fogelberg said years and years ago in an interview, he said, if I wrote one song in my life, it would have been Leader of the Band. And he said, that's my song. That's the one that I'm the most proud of. What is your Leader of the Band song for you? What if you could scrap everything that you've done and you only wrote one song in your life that you've written, what song would that be for Chris Hughes?
Picking from my vast catalog of songs, at this point, probably If I, and the only reason I say that is because If I, essentially, the lyric in If I, when I wrote it, I sat back and I pondered, you know, so many people have that thought in their mind, man, if I only had, you know, if I only had a little bit of money, I could so-and-so, or if I only had, and they ponder, man, if I, and so I just kind of ran with that a little bit. If I had some money, if I had a girl, if I had, and so of the ones I've written, that's probably one of the plainest, the most natural tunes that came to me real easy. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the ones that Zach helped me write that one. And and we also wrote it, half of it, in Odessa, Texas.
Really?
When we were down there for a high school reunion. So
interesting. And I really didn't think about this or plan it. Would you care to share that song? Do you feel like picking and singing that? If not, no big deal. But
yeah, we could do that.
Okay.
With my beans. If I had money, I'd buy all my kids new jeans. When I was a young man, I had such lofty dreams. If I had money, if I had a woman, it would love me to the end. Righteous, but she knows just where I've been. Why should she want me since I'm so filled up with sin? If I had a woman, if I had a woman, when I look into the mirror, me when I gaze into a legacy of a man that lived for his greed. If I look into the mirror, will I like what I see? And if I never make my million, I'll buy my castle by the sea. keep playing this old guitar. I do my best to live by my word and let all the smiles step in. Yeah.
Chris, thanks for sharing that song. I know I caught you a little off guard with asking you to play that, but you know what I've never probably shared with you, that, well, there was really, I guess, never really a time or a place to share it, but when you play your songs on stage in our shows together, I almost enjoyed just watching you play, you know, and I love that. I love music. I'm very attentive with music. Yeah, I get just as much enjoyment of watching you and watching others play versus myself. Like, I'd rather just do that. That's just the way I've always been.
I've gotten to the point now where, thank you so much. I really like to be in a listening environment, and it's so difficult these days. You know, acoustic, the singer-songwriters depend so much. Good ones depend on people who sit and listen, as opposed to carrying on conversation, doing all the things that it's so difficult in bars sometimes for a singer-songwriter, especially when you're doing original music. Sure. And stuff like that, you know.
Well, you've met my buddy Mark down at Clancy's. He was my musical mentor for many, many years. I remember driving down San Felipe one night and hearing this amazing voice, and the guy was just shredding a 12-string guitar, and I'm like, oh, let me pull in there and see what's happening. And it just so happened to be Mark playing there that night. And we became good friends over the years. He wound up playing at mine and Terry's wedding reception. And I spent some time in California with him. And I can remember seeing him play hundreds of times. And I always watched his stuff intently, just like I'd never seen him before. Like, it never got old to me. And he said, Randy, if everybody was like you, an audience like you, guys like me would have it made. And he said, he told me this probably about 6 months ago. He texted me and he said, you know, you and Chris sound phenomenal together. You get better every time I see you. He said, but I don't envy you these days sitting in these places and playing with people on their cell phones and watching TV, and he's like, it's a different time now than when I came up, right? And it's tough. It's tough to pilot because we're delivering a story, right? And it's almost like somebody talking to you, and you just keep watching TV on them, and it's a little disheartening sometimes,
and, right? To be real honest, I mean, to be perfectly honest, that is one of the primary reasons that I don't go out and play more often. I mean, for most people would think, well, if you could play 5, 6, 7 nights a week, fantastic. And in all reality, as a sideman, I probably could find 3, 4, 5, 6 nights a week to go play and stuff like that. But it's really difficult to navigate that kind of thing. And so you wind up taking less in order to play to places that have more people that appreciate what you're doing, if that makes any sense.
It makes 100% sense. And I've said it a million times before. To me, and I'm saying it because I don't make a living playing music. I have a 9-to-5 that I go, or 8-to-5 that I go work. So it's a little bit different of a thought process. But I say it from the heart. I would rather, I mean, the applause means more to me than a $5 bill in my tip jar.
No, most certainly.
Because that's what fuels guys like you and I to write songs, to perform songs, to come and deliver a 3.5-minute story through a set of 6 strings and your vocals, right? Just the clap. And sometimes you don't even pull that from some of these places. And it's, you know, I don't ask for much. I really don't. But that applause means everything. That's what fuels us to keep going.
It certainly doesn't hurt. And I'll say this also, is that there was a point in time that I lived off of that applause. And if I didn't get that, and I had actually, I retired because A, we weren't making any money. And B, you know, it didn't appear that we were getting the attention that we deserved. And so that really got to me. And as a result of that, I wound up retiring for several years in between 2013, when I left Zach's band, until 2017, I had pretty much just given up music altogether. And thank goodness it wasn't the applause or anything else that got me back. It was the music. It was just the music, and it kind of called to me. So yeah, the applause is great, and I don't, you know, and that's one of the reasons that I continue to go out and do the thing. But it certainly isn't the amount of money that we make as players doing what we do.
Sure. Well, I agree 1,000% that the guys that are doing this for a living, unless you've got a record contract with a major label, musicians are probably not making the kind of money that a lot of people think that they're making. So
You make a choice. It's a sacrifice thing. I sacrifice X amount of comfort in my life to be able to play music for a living.
Sure. So that's, you know, that's kind of a segue into the listeners that are out there hearing this story from two musicians sitting across the table when you're at these different places, restaurants or bars or whatever. Just a simple applause just sometimes is what gets us from one show to the next, right?
Yeah, a little bit of applause, you know, pay attention, maybe a buck in the tip jar every now and then. Yep. Walk up and tell the guys they're doing a good job or something. Sure. You know, that's a good thing, and it helps guys out.
Absolutely. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about Zach Perry, and I wanted to understand about, take me back to where did you meet Zach at? How did that friendship develop back whenever?
I was playing with a guy named Skip Devlin, and I had met my wife, and she knew Zach, and she just had seen me play with Skip and had seen Zach play and just knew it was a match. These guys would just be fantastic together. So she introduced us. We wound up kind of getting acquainted with one another. And right about that time, Zach had a bass player leave his band. And so I picked up his seat, and we just started recording and playing around the area. We played for a couple of years, played quite a few shows, recorded his record, Broken Glass Parade.
Great record. I think before I had met you, I had gone down and was at the poop deck, and Zach said, bring your guitar down and jam. And, you know, I'm probably one of the most humble musicians ever. Like, I know my place, and like we talked about being a good listener. Sometimes I just prefer to listen. And I remember going down to the poop deck, didn't take the guitar. I was certainly felt outclassed by Zach. Anybody that plays with Zach, well, probably not you, but a lot of people would feel outclassed by him because he's a great artist, right?
Exactly.
And he said, "You got the guitar in the car?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't bring it, man. You know, this is your show, and I came to watch." He's like, and I don't stack up anyway. He's like, "Music's not a competition."
Most certainly.
And I never had it put to me that way, and I thought that was cool as shit for him to even, you know, and I'm not a shitty musician, right? But I mean, you know, he's played with some of the best out there.
Oh, certainly. That's one of the big appeals about him is that you know, music is extremely inclusive and everybody needs to grab an instrument and grab something and play and off we go. And that's how he feels about it. And he wants everybody to get in and play. And I feel like if everybody's grabbing something, playing, taking part, you know.
Sure.
Everybody kind of focuses on the music rather than
I've seen people take everything from congos to, you know, I've seen the YouTube videos of like, where'd this guy come from? Like him and his dog show up, just a bathing suit, no shirt on. He's sitting there beating on the drums. I'm like, and Zach's just doing what he does, you know, that not even bothered, you know, whether the guy's even keeping the right tempo or not, or even knows the song, but it's just the collaboration that they're sitting there playing together is just cool as shit.
He's pretty loose spirited. The first argument that Zach and I ever got into was on the telephone, and I said something to the effect of, I hadn't been in the band very long, and I said something to the effect of, wouldn't it be great if we wrote out a set list? And so
did he slap you?
Well, once again, we were on the phone,
right?
Virtual and it's funny enough, and it wasn't directly. This kind of sparked it because it was a thing, and it wasn't directly because of that. But I wound up leaving the band not long after that. I did. I wound up returning later, but
It's funny because I see the two of you guys, and I played with him, and I've certainly played a lot more with you, but you and I are probably more alike in the fact that we're very methodical. We're very OCD. We need things a certain way. I see how you load in. I see how you load out, and you probably see a little bit of that in me too. So we're kind of the two peas in the pod where I think Zach is more, like you said, a little more free-spirited about coming and going, and there's no defined anything much with Zach, like, and that's a great thing, but that's what makes Zach.
Oh, right? There's times I want to shoot him out of a fucking cannon. But once again, that's the exact thing that makes us play well together, is he's kind of one side of the coin and I'm the other side of the coin.
Yeah, you know? They say opposites attract sometimes, right? And I think there could be no truer adage. Now, I know that he made his second home in Proissart, France, and has a very solid and huge following over there. When he returned from France, I think when COVID hit, you guys went into the studio together and started recording an effort. You talked a little bit about it earlier, but can you maybe expand upon it? Like, who wrote the songs? Was it just you two guys? Did you collaborate with others? Tell us a little bit about the making of that.
We're both really proud of the record, and we're not necessarily so proud of the record because it's a record that's going to go out there and compete with Sony or any of these things. But we're proud of the record because it is an extremely simple, raw effort. They're all of mine. There's six songs, three of Zach's and three of mine. We played all the instruments and recorded all the parts, and we did them at my studio. And it's a very humble studio. So essentially the record was recorded in a space about, I'd say 10 by 15. And it just
typical bedroom then, basically, it's, right?
A home studio type thing, but we just spent the time and did it. And so as a result, it's kind of an intimate thing, and it's a raw thing, and it's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's what it is. And so I'm real excited about it.
And it's my understanding too that it's a band type effort. It's not just two guys playing the acoustic guitar, right? I mean, you have drums, bass.
It started out when we conceived the album. It was going to be two guys on acoustics, maybe an occasional lead guitar and some hand percussion, that type thing. And true to normal Chris fashion, as I went down to start getting percussion instruments for the studio, I realized that I might as well just go buy an acoustic, an electronic drum kit. So I bought an electronic drum kit, and since I play bass, it all of a sudden turned into more of a band type effort. Now, once again, I play the bass and the drums on the record, so it's still two guys.
Sure.
But yeah.
But what the listeners will hear is, yeah, they won't know the difference.
Right. We changed the instrumentation up a little bit, so there's some electric love in there.
Sure. Did you ever travel overseas with Zach? Did you spend any time in France with Zach, or did that never, you stayed stateside while he was?
Correct.
I know Vern was over there with him, right, at the time.
Right. And when, by the time, I left Zach's band 2013, started playing music in 2017, right around that area, a couple of years, I guess it wasn't very long after that, that he had gone to France. And so he and I hadn't even kind of hooked back up when he was over in France. And it wasn't until he kind of came back from COVID that we wound up even hanging out, visiting, playing together at all again. As a matter of fact, in between those years, in between 2013 and probably 2020, if we had said 10 words to each other, that would surprise me.
Sure.
We just completely lost touch.
Yeah. When you have this effort mastered, do you know how the listeners will be able to get their hands on it, where it will be for purchase, where they'll be able to listen? I'm assuming iTunes, Spotify, will it, you know, can you speak to that at all? Or have you not thought that far down the line
yet? I've considered all those different avenues. At this point, I'm not sure if I'm going to instantly release it on those platforms. And I think probably the biggest reason for that is Zach and his following in France and his label over there. And then he has another album that's forthcoming, that's his Waking the Vulture record that will be coming out. With all those things, I'm just not sure exactly how we're going to do it yet, because I just don't know yet.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
we may want to sell it directly off their site for a little bit before we release it. We may just sell them off the stage. We may hand them out. We may shoot them out of a cannon or drop them from airplane.
Sure.
Like dead turkeys. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I would say that you guys, when it drops, if you guys want to reach out and contact me even, and I can certainly get in touch with Chris and Zach to help promote that and sell the effort, if you guys are willing. So randy@randyhulsey.com, or Chris, what's your email if people want to reach out directly to you and inquire about buying the release once it's out?
Probably the best way to get a hold of me right now is chrishughestexasmusic@yahoo.com.
Perfect. And do you, or have you thought about, And if you don't or can't or whatever, don't want to talk about it, let's just say move on. Have you thought about the branding? Like, is it going to be branded Chris and Zach or Perry and Hughes? Do you have a band name? Is it going to be, you know, how is it going to be branded? Can you speak to that?
Yeah. And essentially, it's called, the album will be called The Sea Shack Recordings, Volume 1. And okay. And the working title on it is called What It Is.
Okay.
Say it would be Zach Perry and Chris Hughes. And the Sea Shack Recordings, it's kind of a concept because this won't be the only one.
Okay.
We're going to assume when we drop this one, Zach has his different recordings going with Zach Perry and the Beautiful Things. Mm-hmm. And that is one complete difference. It's a different style than what we do. And so we'll put these little collections out intermittently.
Yep.
In the meantime, yeah.
Well, I really look forward to them. Let's jump over real quick and talk high level about gear. Guitars. I know you carry a few guitars with you on stage when you and I play. Talk to the listeners a little bit about what you're playing.
Right now, my best acoustic is a Gibson SJ 200 Studio Walnut Burst, and it's a really it's a fine Gibson tone wood acoustic. And I have a an Epiphone that's a super jumbo. It's also an acoustic electric, and it's based off of the Gibson. When the Gibson had to go back in the shop, I'd gotten it. And so I have both of those guitars, and then I also have a Martin acoustic that I carry around with me. And it's one of the less expensive half-breed Martins with the fiber sides and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Top. But, and so for me, the biggest reason I like to have one tuned standard in case I break a string. And then I also like to have one of my instruments that's tuned with a capo on it in case we go to a song with capo, so I don't constantly have to retune with a capo on. So I'll generally keep either two or three different tunings available at all times.
That makes sense. And what are your thoughts around somebody that tunes down a half step? You and I do, but and that's my preference, and I do that for vocal reasons, but is that an anomaly? Like if you played with 10 musicians, how many of them would be tuned down a half step or a whole step and not just staying in standard tuning?
Zach and I, when we first started playing together, we were tuned down a half step.
Okay.
And we did it for vocal reasons, because it is considerably easier on your voice. And there's a buddy of mine, Lightning Rob, the Lightning Rob band out of Galveston, real popular band right now, and they tune a half step down, and I'm sure it's vocally. And so a lot of people do it. The only real problem with that is sometimes people say that their guitars don't intonate as well. They don't tune quite as well, drop down a half step, especially the acoustics. And then secondarily, if you have other people come play with you or stuff like that, and they pop up on stage,
it's foreign to them.
Yeah, they better know that you're tuned down a half step or it's going to sound like a train wreck. But other than that, it's pretty good. And lots of people do it, you know.
Well, I do know that Zach was tuned down half step for a while, but now he's gone back to a standard tuning, is my understanding.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just for keeping it simple, I don't know, or maybe he's just having so many different people come up and jam with him.
From having talked to him, part of it was when there was open mics and things going on, but also one of the things was tuning issues, and I think part of that was with his he has a Les Paul that's a beautiful instrument. But I think that guitar in particular was part of the reason that he had gone back to tuning in regular A440.
Yeah. That makes sense. And what about from a pedal perspective? I know you carry a slew of pedals, and maybe not so much you don't use them during our shows. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But probably when you play someplace like Sharky's with Zach full band, I'm sure those pedals become a little bit more needed, right? So talk a little bit about your pedals, maybe some go-to pedals and sounds that you like.
I carry my pedal board's gotten pretty large, but for the most part, I like relatively simple sound. For me, 90% of the pedals that I have been bought in reference to having available for recording. So it's there if I need it. Like everything else I do, I wind up carrying a bunch of shit around that I'll only use very seldom, but I'd rather carry it around and have it than not, you know.
I'm kind of that mindset too. I'd rather have too much than not enough, and then bitch that I carry too much, right?
That's as far as pedals and amps and things like that go, I've always been a big fan of Fender amps. But I have recently started using Blackstar amps, and so I run Blackstar amplifiers, and I'm real big on Wampler pedals. And so I have several different distortion pedals that I run on my board at all times, but I don't use them at all times.
Sure.
But your basic distortion, chorus, a little echo, reverb, pretty simple sound is my favorite, my stuff.
Yep. And then what about the music that you and Zach are recording? What tools are you using on the computer for the home recording?
My DAW platform is PreSonus Studio One, and I used Studio One Pro version 5 plus. And then I have SoftTube emulations of large format mixers, which for Joe listening guy out there, it just means it copies a great big studio mixer.
Sure.
And so I use SoftTube emulations in PreSonus Studio One, and I also use Audient interfaces and things like that.
Gotcha. And I use Cubase in my studio, and I really think that having a piece of recording software that you like and that you use is kind of like the beer or cigarette of choice. It's like the first cigarette you ever smoke. If it's a Marlboro Light, that's what you're going to smoke the rest of your life, probably, right? If you're a Coors Light guy, you're going to drink Coors Light the rest of your life.
There was a point in time when Pro Tools was the industry standard, and if you weren't using Pro Tools, then it's pretty much you weren't going to get taken. Your project needed to be on Pro Tools. Now, Cubase was one of the ones that started out pretty early, and they were in there for a long time, but now it's gotten to the point to where all of the software is so functional that once you find one that you particularly like, you're good to go. And the industry standard has changed considerably.
Sure. Well, in full transparency, I think I bought my little two-channel audio interface, my USB, that I could plug my guitar in and record directly to the computer for those listeners that don't know much about recording. And it was the Steinberg UR22. And with that came a watered down light version of Cubase, right? I used until.
I think they called it Cubasis or something.
Maybe
at
so,
one
yeah.
Point. Yeah. And I believe that's the first one that I had as well. Once you find your way around one of those software packages,
you don't want to relearn something else because they're very complex.
Yeah, right? But also they do kind of help. One kind of teaches you a little bit about the other.
Yeah.
So once you learn one, learning another one isn't quite as difficult.
Exactly. Well, let's jump into some quick fire questions. Beatles or the Stones for Chris Hughes?
I'm a Beatles guy.
That's interesting because we do some. I don't think we do any Beatles songs together, but we do quite a few Stone songs together.
Right.
So I would have thought the opposite. So I learned something today. How about TV or radio?
TV. I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed to say TV.
That's what's wrong with you. You watch too much damn TV.
I'm an addict.
How about Perfect Vacation for Chris Hughes?
I live my vacation every day. I live on Galveston Island. If I walk out my front door and take out walking in 2 minutes, I will be standing knee deep in the Gulf of Mexico.
So you don't have far to go.
I don't have far to go at all.
Acoustic or electric?
Years ago, I would have said electric. I think acoustic now. I think it kind of suits where I am in life a little bit better.
I think there's a rawness to the acoustic that it's the artist in a simple, watered down, I shouldn't say watered down because Tone Woods are not cheap guitars,
right?
And you spend a lot of money for what we play, but it is just raw. It's just unplugged, right? Right. And I think that there's nothing better than just hearing, like you played a couple of things earlier, it's just you and the guitar. There's nothing fabricating a sound. There's no gimmicks. There's no trickery to it. What you hear, it's kind of WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get, right?
Yeah. When
sounds great or sounds like shit, but either way, it's real and it's raw.
There have been times in my career that I have been a faster guitar player or possibly done more tricks and stuff, but I don't know that I've ever been a better guitar player than I am now, and I think probably 99% of the reason of that is because I put down the electric for so long and played the acoustic so much more, and really, instead of just woodly, 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 sat down to listen to what it was I was doing, tried to play a little bit slower, tried to get that slow hand thing happening.
Absolutely.
A little bit more.
Yep. Favorite guitar. And it doesn't even have to be one you own, just favorite guitar in general.
Oh, gosh. You know, I'll tell you, one of my one of my very favorite guitars, aside from the one that I'm holding, is my cousin Jason's Gibson. I believe it's an SJ-180. And he purchased that, and gosh, I guess he got it from a guy who had, I think it was Big Note Studios in Abilene or something. Lots of famous people have recorded on that guitar, and he was the inspiration. He was actually the inspiration for me getting this one.
No kidding. Okay.
Yeah, so definitely the Gibson Super Jumbos.
Rock or country?
Definitely country now.
Yeah.
And I would say probably closer to Americana or Texas country.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that, because that's kind of how my taste has shifted over time, getting into the Americana genre and Texas country, red dirt stuff, where before 2016, I didn't give a damn about any of that. It was, you know, the Aussies and the Sabbath and all the stuff from the 70s, Firefall, and, right, you know, like, right, that's what, I was a rock pig. That's what I was.
Yeah,
that's
me
what
too.
I loved.
And I thought country is where it's real now, or I say country, Americana, Texas country, red dirt, that sort of thing is kind of where it's real.
Yep. And then what about early bird or night owl?
Both.
Favorite place to play? Maybe out of all the places that you've ever played.
Out of all the places that I've ever played, what has been the favorite? Gosh, that'd take me a second to think about. But I think at this point, you know, probably, I personally like the bigger crowds. And so we've done some things where we, I guess back in Odessa, the first big crowd that I ever played to was probably my favorite and gave me the big, we opened for Head East.
Oh yeah, flat as a pancake.
Yeah, and it wasn't too long after that, you know, record and everything, and they played a big festival out there, and we were the popular rock band in town, so we got to open out there at a Speedway. But you know,
I think that might be what, would you say that Never Been Any Reason might be the only, or one of the only few hit songs that Head East ever had?
I think that was their big hit. I think that was their only hit. But if you'll listen to that record, The Flat as a Pancake,
that's
to me, it was one of my, it was probably, I'd say top 10, but that's given it quite a bit. But I listened to that album front to back 10 billion times.
I'll have to listen to it front to back, and I haven't done that. I've never owned the vinyl. I've started getting into collecting vinyl as of late, so I'm going to see if I can track that one down for sure and give it a listen.
If there was ever a case to be made for the 8-track tape, that would be it, because you plugged in an 8-track, and that sumbitch would go until you jerked it out of the player.
Yep, you're right, it would. How about favorite song to play live?
That would have to be, I can't say currently, but my favorite song to have played live would be YYZ, Rush YYZ. And I used to play that with Keith Gwynn and Biff Eaton and Lisa with a band called Silent Majority back in Odessa. And that's, we used to do some Rush and stuff like that.
Nice. So I'll put you on the spot and give you a Rush trivia question.
Don't. Or go ahead.
What is YYZ?
I have no idea.
Or as they call it in Canada, YYZ.
I'm almost guessing it's some kind of distress signal or code of some sort, but I have no idea.
So like your airport here is IAH? That's their airport in Toronto, YYZ.
Well, I appreciate you making me look foolish in front of God and everyone.
Well, if there's anything else I can do for you today, let me know. We'll go to the Creekwood tonight, and I'll say something stupid there to put you on the spot. I don't know. I'm just not going to talk about that record again, because I'm already on thin ice, so I'll pick another joke tonight.
Well, we're close enough to getting it out. I'll just ignore you.
Right. Number one influential musician or band for Chris Hughes?
I think I would probably have to say Zeppelin as an overall influence, but there are a couple of players that influence me heavily as far as my style and my playing. The guys in Skynyrd were some of the guys that influenced my play. And Pat Travers, guy out of Canada. Probably when I hear that guy in my playing all the time.
Yeah.
Even in this current record, which is kind of weird.
So thank you guys for listening in. Chris, I want to thank you for coming all the way out to Cyprus. Well, you already had to because we're playing here in Cyprus tonight. But thank you for coming here and sharing your story. I think that all the listeners will certainly like to hear kind of your background. I think a lot of them, you know, kind of my little following in and around town know you through me and vice versa. So I it'll be nice for them to be able to hear. Who is this Chris Hughes guy you're playing with?
I hope those folks will come out and say hey and shake my hand and say hi and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and there's nothing that's more pleasing to a musician for people to stop by and introduce themselves. But we love to get to know new people. We see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd a lot of times, but it's always nice to meet some new people and have some new people that enjoy the songs that we're delivering. As always, you guys can find the show on Facebook at Backstage Pass Radio Podcast, on Instagram at Backstage Pass Radio, on Twitter at Backstage Pass PC, and then on the website at BackstagePassRadio.com. Make sure to look Chris up on, I know you're on Facebook. I don't know that you're on anything. Are you on Instagram too?
No.
Just Facebook is really the main place
Facebook
to find you
right now.
And that's where you can find Chris's, you know, shows that he's playing with me and whoever else that he decides to run out and play some songs with. You guys look him up there on Facebook. Again, Chris, thanks for being such a gracious guest, and look forward to many more fun shows and getting to know you better and coming down to the island and seeing you play sometime. You guys take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you right back here on the next episode of Backstage Pass Radio.
Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Backstage Pass Radio. Make sure to follow Randy on Facebook and Instagram at Randy Halsey Music and on Twitter at R Halsey Music. Also, make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on alerts for upcoming podcasts. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to share the link with a friend and tell them Backstage Pass Radio is the best show on the web for everything music. We'll see you next time right here on Backstage Pass Radio.